You are listening to tape number 3 out of a 5-tape series entitled Treasures of Healing, Trouble, and Hope. The title of message number 3 is Hidden Treasures, or Hunting for Hidden Treasures. It is given by Dr. Haddon Kleinberg.
We're looking for hidden treasures tonight, and we'll go after 8 of them, and I want to tell you at the beginning that what I'm suggesting is that you look for the hidden treasures in paradox. All 8 of the hidden treasures I'm talking about are hidden partly because they're paradoxical. They don't make much sense. To those of us who've grown up in America, in the Western world, and whether you know it or not, you high school kids and college students, the textbooks you read are primarily based on Aristotelian logic and the scientific method. And I never knew until in seminary I started to take Hebrew, I never knew that there was any other way to think or any other way to look at the world. And then I found there was a language that didn't even connect with the way we think. And then I found out that the whole of the Old Testament was written kind of through other eyes. And paradox began to sit down and be comfortable in the living room of my mind and of my feelings. And all the treasures I'm talking about are hidden in paradox. I'm going to try to drag you along with me to try to accept and understand that paradox is true. And here are some ways it shows up for us. First paradox. The first hidden treasure is finding Christ. Now, what is the beginning of the Christian life? It's when you find Christ, right? Wrong. I can ask a question like that of the student body of North Park College. And they say the beginning of the Christian life is when I give my life to Christ. It's not so. It's not so. It may seem like it, it may feel like it, but that's not at all how it works. One of the reasons that we don't find Christ is fairly basic. He's not the one that's lost. Why search for him? He's not lost. Why do we think our Christian pilgrimages begin when we find him at last, as though he were hiding from us, or as though he'd lost his way? It is impossible for us to find him. No one here has ever seen him. It is impossible in all of our searching to find him. Our searching is only the reflection of his search. If you're looking for him, you can take heart a little bit, because that may just be a reflection of the fact that he's stalking you. Like a detective, he's following you, and you have some intuition that you're aware of that. And yet your experience is that you're looking for him, you're calling for him, you're trying to find him somewhere. We are the sought. We are not the seekers. We do not turn to Christ. He has turned to us. And any turning we do is just response to that. We are not the ones who belong to the kingdom because we have given our lives to Christ. We belong to the kingdom because it is Christ who has given his life to us. And there's no other way about it. Even though most of the testimonies I heard led me to believe that if I looked long enough, I'd find him. And when I found him, if I gave my life to him, he'd be satisfied with that. And it's not so. This is how the Christian life begins for everybody. And I don't think our individual differences change it any. Though our experiences are wonderfully varied. Now, why some people go on so long a pilgrimage, I don't know. When Christ is seeking and he's there and he's already done all the searching that needs to be done, but Gertrude Bahana is a lady who was converted to Christ in her 60s. She grew up in the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, a spoiled brat if there ever was one. She was an alcoholic, divorced 2 or 3 times, went out to the Mojave Desert and tried to kill herself. She couldn't even do that. She had a spastic colon. She had everything in the book. And one day she went to a psychiatrist, and he said, "The problem with you, Gert, is there's nothing wrong with you. And what you need is God." And she said she'd never heard his name before, never met a Christian in her life. And she met an Episcopal priest who helped her understand that Christ had found her. And then you know what she says in her testimony? "When you've been lost as long as I have, you never get over the wonder of being found." Has it ever crossed your mind, if you're a searcher and you can't find, that God in some mysterious and merciful way is holding out on you so that when you know you have been found, you'll be unable to get past it, you'll be unable to get over it, so glad you will be? I think that's why some people search so long when they've already been found. Your longings and search may be a gift from Christ. And in his love, he may leave you lost for a while. When I was a little kid, my family used to go to the Eastern States Exposition in Springfield, Massachusetts. Let's hear it for Springfield. New England states are very small, and they're all pushed together, so there's one big fair for the Eastern States in Springfield. And I was a little kid, and I loved machinery. I still do. I love gadgets. And we went into the farm implements building, the industrial building, and here's a whole big building full of garden tractors and machines. And I remember I found a garden tractor. I don't know if I was more than 6 or 7 years old. And I found one that fit me just right, and I sat down there and I began to plow the fields of my fertile imagination. And I was just all caught up with this equipment. And after I'd played a long time and probably was getting a little tired of it, I looked around for my family, and they were gone. And my small boy heart filled up with panic and terror and fear. I got off the tractor, and I began to run up and down. I mean, for a 6-year-old kid, that building was like a cosmos. Now I think it looks so little, the building, because it's all appears different. As a kid, it was like being lost in a galaxy. And I ran up and down the aisles of the industrial building. And then I thought I saw my dad through my tears, and I would run to him only to find out it was somebody else's dad. And the more I looked, the more I searched, the more frightened I became. Do you know where my dad went when he discovered that I wasn't walking around with a family? He went back to the place where I had become lost while I was out searching for him. Now you see, I had an imperfect childhood faith in my father. I should have known that he never would have left the building without me, never would have left the fairgrounds. He was probably over there lost and found and information and doing all kinds of logical, rational things to track me down. And probably without panic. And there I was. The lesson that I didn't understand is that the only place I can be found is the place I got lost. That's fairly basic. And there are lots of people who try to change themselves in order that they find Christ. And in the process of changing themselves, move farther away from the possibility of being found. Because he only takes you with your real true story. Not a fixed up story, but the real one, plain the way it is. The only story he deals with. It's the only story he connects to. And I didn't understand that as a child, and I haven't understood it yet fully. I only know that the chances of being found are best in your own story, without the works of the flesh. All right? That's the first hidden treasure in paradox. The second one sounds a little like the first one. It's not finding Christ, it's knowing Christ. Knowing Christ. I hear everybody tell, now that I have come to know Christ, as if, in fact, anybody here really knew him in the sense of understanding him, or grasping him, or getting him under control. The Apostle Paul, in one place, is writing, and you know what he says? He stops his pen and he corrects it. He says, now that I have come to know Christ, or rather, now that Christ has come to know me, and then he goes on with his paragraph. There's the hidden treasure in the paradox, and Paul talks about it in many different ways in many different places. Ladies and gentlemen, your Christian confidence, the strength of your faith, is not tied to the level of your understanding of Christ. It is tied to your beginning grasp that he understands you. Your Christian faith is not held up by what you know. It is held up by some sense that Christ gives to you, that you are known. Do you see why we search for the answers to all this suffering stuff? Because we think that we are the ones who are supposed to know. And what we really wish in our deepest heart is some sense of confidence that we are known, that we are found. If we only had that, a lot of the other questions might simmer down. Peter Taylor Forsythe says, we began seeking God because we felt so able and so sure to find him. We end by serving him because he has sought and found us disabled and unsure. We began with a love of justice and we end with a prayer for justification. We begin by willing and knowing, we end by being willed and being known. That's part of the paradox, the hidden treasure there. The third paradox is like the other two, and that has to do with loving Christ. Lots of people will tell you that a Christian is someone who loves Jesus. Well, that's true, but that's not how it begins. A Christian is one who loves Christ and others. How does it begin? New Testament writers say it is not that we loved God, but that he loved us and gave his Son. Anybody know the expression self-actualization? Go on back to the self-improvement section of any bookstore. You'll find books on how to actualize yourself, how to fulfill yourself, the human potentials movement. It's got the bookshelves packed. I was trained. I got a PhD in the human potentials movement. It's a big thing about everybody's getting better every day in every way, and if you could only realize your fullest potential, then you'd blossom into everything you ever wished that you could become. It's called the realization, self-realization, self-development. It's tied into this whole me culture, my story and me, and how to make the most of my story. Nuts to what it might do to other people. How I can make the most out of me and my potential. I heard a psychologist in Chicago talking about the self project. He talked about how he'd worked on his self project all his life long. You know what he said? What a ghastly job it is to work on your self project all the time. Then he raised the question about whether there might be more promise in self-denial and self-actualization, and he was on the threshold of the Christian gospel. Self-denial, I'm going to leave alone for a little while. The only place it makes any sense is out of a greater love, out of some greater gain, which is the fruit of Christian life and experience, not the beginning of it. We'll get to that. Number five, God stalks us and we miss seeing him in the everyday. We're being stalked, we're being followed, we're being tailed by God, but we miss seeing him in the everyday. Now let me tell you a little bit more about my story, only because I think that your story is connected to mine. And it's the thing I know best. It's not great, but it's what I know best. I'll tell you about three people, and I never knew that Christ was in any of them at the time. See those three circles there? I already knew what I was going to tell you about. Those are three important people who connected to my story, though I was never able to connect the whole thing to his story, certainly not to your story or their story, but they were important to me. One was my Uncle Eddie. The guy called him Mal by mistake once in a restaurant, so that's what I always called him thereafter, Mal. And Mal was an illustrious graduate of the eighth grade. He earned a pathetic little living as a cook. He married once and lost his marriage and his wife. And in his later years, he became what we know as a mental case. And every 3 or 4 years was locked up in what he called the bug house, a place in central Connecticut, a state mental hospital. And he was locked up there for what I since have learned is called a manic depressive psychotic episode, which repeated itself every several years. And there were a lot of people in our church and people who knew him who just sort of laughed Uncle Ed off. But something very special happened between me and Uncle Ed over a period of years. I want to tell you that one of the newest things to show up in behavioral psychology is talk about a rooting section. I don't mean roots in the sense of roots of a plant. I mean roots in the sense of cheerleaders. You know what a rooting section is at a football game? All right. The last 15 years of a new wave in psychology in this country has been behavior modification. How to help other people change the way they act so that they can have a better life and better relationships and so on. Now the new wave is cognitive behavior modification. If you can get people to think differently about themselves in the world, they'll behave differently. So change mental behavior and so on. Now you know what has showed up just very recently is talk about the importance of a rooting section to a human being. I heard a psychologist say recently, it isn't really much use to use the methods of behavior modification or psychotherapy on a human being who has no rooting section. A person who is not aware that there's anybody in this world who cheers for him, to whom he or she is someone special, someone who follows, someone who's connected. And it's kind of a depressing note from psychology to say all the stuff we've learned really is applied for no gain. It's no use to do it to a person who doesn't know that there's anyone in his or her rooting section. You follow? Now, as far as I know, medicine hasn't asked the question yet. It'd be a tough question to ask. Why operate? Why spend medical money and technology on someone who, after surgery, will still not even have one person to care for him or her. Why do it? What's the use? You can't fix up a person like that. At least not for the long haul. That's a fascinating new question to be raised by the technicians of how to help people out. I gotta tell you, my Uncle Eddie was for a span of several years number one in my rooting section. A lot of people thought he was a screwball. But nobody knows how he and I sat out on a playground at Klingberg Family Centers on a bench after dark. And he would talk with me and I would talk with him. And it was so easy to swap our stories with each other. You know what I felt when I was with Uncle Ed? And bless the memory of my dad and mother, but I never felt that they understood me anything like Uncle Ed did. And he's the guy who never went to school. He used to tell me not to do what a lot of folks wanted me to do, but to go away to school. He's the one that kept pushing me to go to seminary and go to PhD school and all that stuff. Stuff he didn't understand at all. And he was a real case when he went out in the trees. I mean, when he went loony, and I hadn't the foggiest idea what was wrong with him or what to do about it. I did not understand his story. And he really didn't understand mine because I was a different age, a different generation. My story was so different from him. But do you know what he told me more than one time with a lot of feeling? Don, you're the only one in the world who understands me. And I felt like my crazy Uncle Ed is the only one in the world who understood me. And really, we didn't understand each other. But you know what we did? We had a powerful affection for each other. I walked on water in his eyes, and he walked on water in mine. And he told me lots of times he was no good, but Jesus Christ would stand in for him. And he was a crazy man, but Jesus still understood him. So there was some bond of affection there. We didn't really, in the sense of wisdom and grasp, understand each other's stories, but we took in each other's stories and owned them and loved them and respected them for what they were. And both stories had plenty of bad stuff in them. But Uncle Ed was in my rooting section. I didn't know Jesus Christ was when I talked with Uncle Ed. All I had was Uncle Ed. He was the only thing I could talk to and listen to and hug. He used to take me to a restaurant and smoke cigars and drink wine and talk about Jesus. And some of the prudes at church criticized him for his cigar. They should have known his story. Cigars had hardly anything to do with anything. If my Uncle Ed hadn't been there, and if he hadn't been in my rooting section, I don't know how my adolescence would have evolved. I actually do not know. Second person I'll tell you about. You see, what I really wanted, you know what I really wanted? Was not to know the why of my pilgrimage, how come all this trouble. What I wanted was to be understood. Just wanted somebody to take me and my story and embrace it. When that happened with Uncle Ed, I didn't ask him any more questions and I felt a certain sense of peace. Second person I'll tell you about is my wife, Jan. It's not all as bad as I've made it sound. But I was a cocky young guy who thought marriage would be a cinch and, that I'd be helping lots of other couples in marriage, and we got married, and I've already told you that Jan and I got into a lot of difficulty, and we're still in the process of working that out, but there were times when things were happening to me that I did not quite understand and comprehend. And one of the things I had never been able to do as a kid or as a young adult, we didn't marry till I was 28, I had never been able to let a person of the opposite sex love me, except my mother. And I had never been able to open myself or even recognize my need of affection or my need of a connection with the story of someone from the opposite sex, though I know we're all supposed to get married and all that. And we did get married, and some of the things that happened to me were most puzzling, though now in retrospect they make sense. They become treasures. I remember one night in my confusion and despair. It was back after we were back in New Britain, Jan. I don't know if you remember it. For the first time in my life, I curled up in my bed in a fetal position like an unborn child. And I asked Jan if she would please put her arms around me and hold me. Something about my story was unfolding in front of my eyes that I didn't even understand. The lesson I began to learn, the only way that I know how to love a woman is to let her love in. The only way I know how to express any affection to her is to ask her to hold me. And I haven't been much of a hero at this over time. But here is another person in whom I didn't see any connection except to my story. We were forced to share each other's stories. I mean, when you're in the same bed, you're stuck with it. And when you've made long-term covenant of marriage, you better believe you're going to get into each other's stories. So it's amazing how some spouses can stay away from each other's stories and live as strangers. But it's a good chance that your stories will connect. And I won't say a whole lot more, but I know there's another significant person in my rooting section. My Uncle Ed died 10 years ago. You know what these psychologists are saying about a rooting section? You can have a powerful rooting section even if the person in it is dead now. You can live off the memory of a rooting section. Makes it easy for me to understand how you can live off the power of having God in your rooting section. You don't have to see him physically. If you knew he was there, what a difference it would make. My Uncle Ed is still in my rooting section, though he's gone. These psychologists also say if your rooting section is still alive, you don't even have to have that much contact. Once a year you could have contact with a rooting section. And it still is the thing that carries you and integrates you. The third person I'll tell you about who's in my rooting section is my son. I never thought I had anything to learn from little kids. I thought I had lots to teach them. When Trav was 3 years old, he and I went to a hardware store in New Britain, a Lehrer's hardware store, to buy some stuff because we were fixing up our house. And he's three, remember? And, you know, pretty good, pretty verbal. And he's three, remember? And, you know, pretty good, pretty verbal, able to talk and fairly bright. And I bought all kinds of stuff, which was in two big paper sacks or bags, which I carried out to the car. And I was saying, hey, Trav, come on with me. And I'm trying to get him along with all the hardware. Got to the car, fumbled for the key, opened the trunk, dropped the two heavy bags down into the trunk and slammed the trunk lid, only to hear Travis scream out. And I turned around and I saw that I had jammed his little finger in between the trunk lid and the side of the car, and it was stuck in there and he couldn't get it out. And of course, I find the key as fast as I can and I open the trunk, and there's his little finger all smashed up. And took him home, then to a radiologist, found out nothing was broken. But you know what a purple fingernail feels like? I don't think he'd had pain like that before. And you know how it throbs? And he had crushed the nail, and it was all bandaged up. And that night, he went to bed, and I went to bed, and I felt so low. And I remember tossing in the night and saying things to myself like, I wish it had been my finger instead of his, and God, isn't there a way to swap fingers in the night somehow? And I felt real, real low, and I decided in the night that I was going to tell Travis the next morning how I felt and what I had thought in the night. And so I did. The next day, I took him in my arms, and I said, I'm so sorry about what I did to you yesterday. And I said, I wish that it had been my finger instead of yours. And he goes, hey, Dad, don't you know this hurts? And I said, yeah, I know it hurts, and I wish it would be my finger instead of yours. But he says, why? And I said, because last night I realized a new thing in my story. I realized that I loved you more than I have ever loved myself. I never thought I ever could care about somebody else's story more than my own. But I was waking up to the fact that the force of my fatherly affection would quickly have swapped fingers with him, or arms or legs, or eyes or ears, or my whole self. And when I told him, and again, little kids, the light goes on, I love you more than I love me, so I would rather be hurt than you. Oh, and he put his arms around my neck, and he squeezed me real hard, and he says, Dad, I love you the whole world. And my eyes were wet, and I was more macho then. So I might have wanted people to think he'd squeezed my Adam's apple too hard. But in fact, I was a grown man soaking up oceans of affection from a small child and pouring back into him oceans of my own affection, which I had always thought myself incapable of. No hope of me so preoccupied with my own story ever pouring out or going out to anyone else and his story. You know what happened during Lent that same year? When I realized that I would swap my body, right here, that I'd give this up for my kid, that's when I knew some new level of affection was in me that I'd never known before. I went to, don't ask me why, nobody told me to, and I hadn't thought about it before. I went to a Roman Catholic bookstore, and we're in Lent now, and I said to the lady, I want to buy a cross to hang around my neck. And she said, do you want it with a corpus or without? And I took Latin in high school, so I remember that corpus meant body. I said, oh, for sure, I want one with a body. And she said, all right. We went in the back room, and I bought myself the first crucifix I ever had. I was told when I was a child that that was idolatry. I can't tell you how I craved to own my first crucifix. You know why? Because there was something about the bodily sacrifice of Christ that Lent that had caught me in a way it never had before, because for the first time in my life, I would have given up my flesh and bone for my son. And I wanted a cross with a body on it. And I bought it. And I wore it through that Lent under my shirt. Didn't dare show it in the Covenant Church. And I wore it through the next Lent. And to this day, between Lents, it hangs on a hook on my bedpost. Between my eyes and the lights of my digital clock radio. And when I'm real, real low, and when I'm low, I'm thinking about only one thing, and it's my story again. Poor, poor me, and my story. When I'm low, there are times when I am able to struggle in the dimness of my clock radio to find the crucifix. And I remember a line I heard when I was in college that I never forgot. It was the preacher who had told us his story. And then he said, "I know what I am, but it doesn't matter anymore because I am eternally loved of God." I recited that line like scripture to myself. And my spirits begin to lift. And I move off of my story onto his story. And his story is that he would swap his flesh and bone for mine. I had told that story over and over again. And it's almost like in those night episodes of mine, as I try to move from my story to his and back to your story, which is where I belong, there is that crucifix. And it's almost like I could sing to myself, pointing to the crucifix, "This is my story. This is my song, praising my Savior all the day long." You may think I'm a crazy man. That happens to me in the night. John 13:1, the same Lenten time. I was reading this, and now the day was of the feast of the Passover. Jesus knew that the hour had come for him to leave the world and go to the Father. He had always loved those who were his own in the world, and he loved them to the very end. And I got out my Greek books and wanted to find out what it meant to the very end. You know what I found out? That it meant to the very end. That it meant he loved them in the end. That it probably meant he loved them decisively, finally, extremely, altogether, fully. He loved them to the extent that beyond it he couldn't possibly love them anymore. I found those kinds of definitions of the Greek word that was used in the passage. And the extent of his love was that there was no more love that could be loved. That's why I wanted his body on the cross, because of that experience I'd had with my little boy connecting to my story. And over the long haul, you see how the connections begin to develop to his story. Through the human rooting section of mine. The eis telos means that he loves you to the end of his life, that he loves you to the end of your life, that he loves the human family to the end of the world, that he loves finally, that he loves forever in the costliest grace of his cross and resurrection. And in that cross and resurrection, he gathers us up in the paradox of human suffering and shared stories. And another hidden treasure unfolds before us. Number 6, the paradox of our suffering in Christ means that he binds us to himself in our suffering. Christ, through our suffering, is making connections between our stories and his. There's a hidden treasure in there. In James chapter 1, do you know what he says to the Christians who are dispersed and under persecution in the world of his time? Count it all joy, count it pure gain when you meet various kinds of trouble, because you know that when you meet various kinds of trouble, it will bring about a test of your faith, and the test of your faith produces steadfastness. And the parallel goes on, that out of your trouble comes tests of faith and the growth of your steadfastness and your ability to face the next trouble and to help others who face the next trouble. And Paul says, consider yourselves lucky when trouble comes. Now that's paradox. because when trouble comes, we think ourselves anything but lucky. He's saying, remember that that trouble produces in you steadfastness and faith and growth. And there are reasons for taking in that trouble and even rejoicing in it. Every trouble that we experience has the potential in it of helping to link our story with Christ's and with one another. C.S. Lewis said, I am progressing along the path of life. In my ordinary, contentedly fallen and godless condition, absorbed in a merry meeting with my friends, or in a bit of work that tickles my fancy today, or a vacation, or a new book, when suddenly a stab of abdominal pain that threatens serious disease, or a headline in the newspaper that threatens us all with destruction, sends this whole pack of cards tumbling down. At first, I am overwhelmed, and all my little happinesses look like broken toys. Then, slowly and reluctantly, I try to bring myself into the frame of mind that I should be in at all times. I remind myself that all these toys were never intended to possess my heart, that my true good is in another world, and that my only real treasure is Christ. But let God sheath that sword for a moment, and I behave like a puppy when the hated bath is over. I shake myself as dry as I can and race off to reacquire my comfortable dirtiness, if not in the nearest manure heap, at least in the nearest flower bed. And that is why tribulations cannot cease until God either sees us remade or sees that our remaking now is hopeless. Number 7. The paradox of our trouble binding us to each other. Nothing connects our stories like trouble, although laughter runs a close second. And we'll talk more about that in a night or two. Laughter is way up there at the top of the list. Suffering maybe helps connect our stories, though, more quickly than anything else. Most of you heard about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, pastor in Germany, Christian pastor. You know, he, for some reason, probably very much tied to his story, to Bonhoeffer's story, and to Christ's story. Something in their stories was powerfully connected. Bonhoeffer resisted Hitler himself in the course of the Holocaust and never gave in to Nazism or the regime or the whole terror that took Europe and the world, and especially the Jewish people, into its own horrors. Bonhoeffer stood against it. He was imprisoned by the Nazi regime for resisting it. And ultimately he was put to death, martyred, for his resistance to the Nazi movement. When he was in prison, he wrote letters to his mom and dad. In one of them he wrote this, I have never realized so clearly what the Bible and Luther mean by spiritual trial. Quite suddenly, for no apparent reason, whether physical or psychological, the peace and placidity which have been a mainstay hitherto begin to waver, and the heart, in Jeremiah's expressive phrase, becomes that defiant and despondent thing which one cannot fathom. It is like an invasion from the outside, as though evil powers were trying to deprive one of life's dearest treasures. But it is a wholesome and necessary experience which helps one to a better understanding of human life. The mystery of our trouble connecting our story. And notice he doesn't say the insight or gaining the understanding to one other person. He's talking about humankind. That his suffering put him in touch with humankind, with all people of all time, seems to be what's in his expression. There is in our suffering the common life and the connections and the links with other people. It's just about 2 years ago that Pope John Paul was shot by a crazy man or someone on a crusade or whatever in St. Peter's Square in Rome. Do you remember that? It was in the news. Just about everyone in the world, I assume, knew about it. Took him quite a while to recover, and then several months later, in October, following the May when he was shot, the United Press International let run a little article in American papers, and it read like this: Pope John Paul II thanked God today for allowing him to test his human weakness by being shot by a would-be assassin in May, and said the suffering he endured was a special grace for him and for the Roman Catholic Church. Now quoting the Pope, God allowed me to experiment with suffering these last few months, allowed me to experiment with the danger of losing my own life, the Pope told 30,000 people at his second outdoor audience since he was seriously wounded. The Pope continued, God allowed me at the same time to clearly understand that this was a special grace for me as a man, and at the same time, considering my role as Bishop of Rome and successor to St. Peter, a special grace for the Church, with great gratitude to the Holy Spirit, I think of that human weakness that he allowed me to test on May 13, believing and humbly trusting that this could serve to strengthen the Church and also my own human person. Number 8. You're going to get to go home pretty soon. God is loving others even when the only thing you have to share is your sad story, or what seems to you no story at all. What is this paradox in the New Testament? Paul says, when I am weak, then I am strong. What is this in the New Testament? Christ's strength is made perfect in weakness. What are these paradoxes that don't fit, that don't make sense? What are the Beatitudes? How fortunate are those who mourn. Lucky are the ones who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. How blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. What are all these paradoxes that make no sense to us? These paradoxes refer to the Christian truth that if God is going to work through you for the good of other people, He can only do it through your true, honest story. You are nearest to being a channel of His holy grace to other people and the world when you are most aware that your story is a sad one and deserves no more time even, but that it is all you have. It must be what He's given you, which seems so little and so dusty in your hands. It is there in that pathetic story, which you may have worked on for 50 years. It's right there in that story that is the connecting point to the grace of Christ and the outpouring of His grace to other people and to this world. Martha Jane Peterson, when she must have been feeling her emptiness, wrote a beautiful poem. She must have been experiencing what it is for Christ to come in our weakness. You almost realize in this that nothing in that story is going to be wasted. All the junk that I would have gotten rid of if I could have, now is not to be wasted. I used to think that I was going to be wasted by my story. Now my story is that I'm to go back in to that pathetic personal pilgrimage and dig out all the hidden treasures that are there, which I despised with my whole heart and strength. I'm to go back there and dig up every link I can to your story and to the story of humankind. And this is what Martha Jane Peterson wrote in one of those experiences. Dry? Hang on, empty one. Cling for life to Him who knows you through and through, and He will fill you up again. Just watch. In His puzzling plan, He'll send a friend whose walk is far more arid than your own. You'll reach way down inside and share your precious bit of faith. And in the sharing, the Spirit's hidden spring will gush up, refill your cup, and flow past the brim, down the sides, and flood your friend as well. Don't underestimate the affection that God has for you and your story. The story before you changed it around. You and your real story with all the details of everything you ever thought or did. How much He waits and longs to gather you up, not without your story, but with your story. You and your story are the same thing. And God would that He could gather you in His arms with your story and there begin to uncover the treasures which you thought were your enemy and which He will turn into your friends and your blessings. Don't underestimate your story. Jan and I one time had some friends in for dinner who had just gotten married. And they were real good friends. And in fact, they had been in our wedding party only a couple years before, and then they got married, and they lived across the country, and they came out to Connecticut, and we were sitting around our table, and I wasn't heavy that night. In fact, we were having a lot of fun. I'll talk about laughter some more, but that was one of the nights we were laughing and having a good time. But Jan and I, for whatever reason, also began to tell Phil and Bonnie about some of the things that we had been through in the first 2 years of our marriage. And most of it wasn't very good. It's not the kind of thing you'd share with people you didn't know well and, you know, who wouldn't understand your story. But we told them, oh, boy, We've been through that, and we didn't know. They didn't share anything of their story with us. All I knew, they were in wedded bliss after 2 months of marriage on the peaks of romance, for all I knew. But we told the truth about what was going on with us. And it was a couple of years later that Phil and Bonnie told us, remember that night we were in your house, and you were telling us about some of the things that you had gone through. And then they said that that night is one of the reasons they were still married. And so we want to hear the rest of the story. What happened was, they were at our dining table, hearing us. When they went out into the car, they got in and closed the door, and Phil said to Bonnie, "Bonnie, if Klingbergs can make it, anybody can." What we didn't know is that they were in deep trouble and thought that they were going to lose their marriage and what was going on with them. And now what good is there in our story, which we wish hadn't happened in some ways? In other ways, they helped us understand. There was a nonchalant, unintentional connection of our story to someone else's. We didn't know about it for months. And it wasn't our success. It was not our strength. It was not our superiority that forged the link. It was the story, which was about all we had, plus the grace of Christ, plus the rooting sections that Jan and I had that helped to pull us through all of that. God is loving others even when the only thing you think you have to offer is your story, or what you think isn't even a story. He is at work in His caring and His loving through who you are and what you are.